everyone. This is Free Food for Thought, a student-run, student-focused podcast here to feed your curiosity. I'm Emma.
And I'm Tutu Jarasadi. And today, we're sitting down with Professor Roth. Professor Roth is the Associate Professor of History and Latin American and Caribbean Studies at the University of Georgia. She also serves as the Director of Graduate Studies in History. Prior to her position at UGA, she was a Marie Curie Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland and a Fulbright Postdoctoral Scholar at Fiocruz in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Professor Roth examines women's reproduction health in relation to legal and medical policy in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Professor Roth provides a new way of interpreting the intertwined histories of gender, race, reproduction, and the state, and shows how these questions continue to reverberate in decades over reproductive justice and women's health in Brazil today. Professor Roth, thank you for joining us. It's a privilege to speak to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with your upbringing. Before we delve into the specifics of your book, could you tell us about when you decided to get involved with women's reproductive health and what led you to that point?
Yeah, so I've gotten this question quite a bit, and I think I've always just been interested in why women and non-binary people are treated differently. They seem to have more of a focus on controlling their bodies, right? And that always interested me just as a girl growing up and as a young woman. And when I got to college, I started taking classes in gender and sexuality studies, and it just really hit me the importance of studying patriarchal norms in the United States and abroad. So I would say it came through just an intellectual curiosity, but based also on growing up as a woman in the United States. I'd also say that I started focusing specifically on Latin America and Brazil in particular because I had always studied Spanish in middle school, high school, and I majored in Spanish in college. And one of the main ways that we learn languages in the United States is through area studies. So, you know, it was either to learn Spanish, to study abroad in Spain, or to study abroad in Latin America. And so that's how I sort of moved into Latin America. And then I started learning Portuguese. And from there, I did more research in Brazil. And so I sort of combined my interest in language learning with my interest in history, and then specifically in the Latin American region.
Yeah, and especially when you're speaking about language, and especially in your book, you look at a lot of documents, right? And the power of language, especially in translation, because there are words that exist in Portuguese that don't exist in English and vice versa. How was that journey? What was that access like to getting those documents? Did you work with anyone?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my book is mainly focused on, I use legal documents, so police investigations or court cases of abortion, infanticide, and other reproductive-related events. And so when I first started the research, my spoken Portuguese was okay, but this is Portuguese of the late 19th, early 20th century, so it's a different Portuguese. It's legal, right? So there's a legalese to it. And it was handwritten. And although it's not the handwritten documents of the colonial period, which are very hard to read because the paleography, as we call handwriting, was different, it still took me a good while of spending, you know, 5 days a week in the archive where I was doing research, reading these documents to understand not only the specific handwriting and styles, but why the legalese, the Portuguese legalese. And so it just takes time. You know, doing scholarship and research takes time. And I think these days everything is digitized and it seems so easy to download a lot of information at the click, you know, of your fingertip. But actually, good scholarship, good intellectual productions take time. And I think we don't really give ourselves enough time in that sense. So it took, you know, spending time with the documents day in and day out, and then just being in Brazil and getting an understanding of how language functioned. I would say that one of the other sort of important things was realizing the way documents were written and what was left out and what was included. So police investigators, if they brought in a woman who they thought had had an abortion, which was illegal in the early 20th century, they wouldn't write down the questions they asked her. They would just write down the answers. And so at first I'm like, oh, is this different? But I realized that was the form of a police investigation. So you also have to sort of realize how things are being written down. And we don't know what the women and men and people involved said. We just know what the police wrote down from what they said. So you always have to read these documents carefully and not say this is exactly what was said, because we will never know that. I think one of the biggest differences is that in English, abortion, there's one word for it, abortion, and that means that it was provoked or it wasn't natural. And we use miscarriage for what in medical terms is called a spontaneous abortion, or the loss of a pregnancy that happened because of natural reasons, whether the fetus wasn't viable or the woman had some health issue. That's called a spontaneous abortion, but we say miscarriage. And in Portuguese, there's no word for miscarriage. It's just aborto, and then it's aborto provocado, or a provoked abortion, and aborto espontaneo, or spontaneous abortion. So the title of my book is A Miscarriage of Justice, Women's Reproductive Lives and the Law in Early 20th Century Brazil. And a miscarriage of justice in English has a connotation of saying that justice was not served. Someone was illegally imprisoned or they shouldn't have gone to prison. And so it's sort of a double meaning, right? There's a miscarriage. Women had poor reproductive health outcomes, but also they were criminalized for abortion. And that is lost in Portuguese, even though the research is about Brazil.
And quickly on that notion about the documents and language, and going back to your original interest in this, I can imagine the emotional component of just reading these documents and feeling it. How was that like? And especially trying to find the women's stories through the lenses of the police, was that really hard to find?
Yeah. So, you know, I read, 250 of these police investigations and court cases around there. And these are heartbreaking stories because they're exceptional events in the sense that most abortions do not come to the police's attention nowadays or in the past, right? And the ones that do often have characteristics that are a little bit more sensational than, let's say, an abortion that the woman didn't die or wasn't found out, right? So we always want to read documents, especially legal documents, with some care because we are getting a little bit of the exceptional rather than the norm. However, these were still women's lives. And so whether or not it was an exceptional circumstance doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously. And like I said, there are heartbreaking stories of women who, you know, one woman had an abortion and she had her 3-year-old son with her and she later died, right? Another woman had been raped and wasn't receiving her wages as a domestic worker and was in very desperate situations. And at first, when I first started doing the research, I kind of tried to ignore my own reaction to the documents, both emotional and physical, because I would read about really, and even now, you know, cases where the police write in a dry tone. Well, then we brought her in and performed a pelvic exam. And on paper, that's like, okay, but in practice, you know, for someone who's had a pelvic exam and to imagine having that after you've had an abortion and you're very scared because the police are going to, you know, investigate you. I thought that it's important to recognize those feelings. And you don't want to center yourself as the researcher because it's not about you, but to acknowledge that doing the work can be difficult and that's not something you should ignore.
Can you speak a little bit more about the relationship between a country's national identity and their woman citizens? It seems through your book that the government had a strong vested interest in women as a national concern.
Yeah, so we think about traditional gender norms, the nuclear family, the traditional family, and these have sort of formed the basis of the modern nation state in many Western countries. And this was the case in Brazil. It is the case in the United States. And, you know, if you want to go all the way back to when human beings domesticated animals and started agriculture, that's when we had private property. And when you have private property, you're going to pass on your property to your offspring. And in that sense, it matters who your children are. And you can never know who the father is, right? So you have to control female reproducers because they are sort of have all of this control of their own body. So in that sense, sort of the, you know, rise of private property is the basis for a lot of these anxieties about women's sexuality. As we move into the modern era, let's say, so I'm skipping, you know, thousands of years, but and the period I was studying, which was the late 19th, early 20th century, you begin to have, you know, you have the have had the Industrial Revolution and these major changes. A lot of nations are becoming independent in Latin America. Slavery is ending in the 19th century. Women, white women, are beginning to demand the right to vote. And these changes are scary for people who are in power. And the people who were in power were mainly white men. And so to control women is to control how the nation forms. You control who is reproducing, how they're reproducing. And in that sense, you can sort of maintain the status quo. And I think fights over abortion today in the United States are really about proper gender roles, or what people think should be proper gender roles, who should have control over their own body, and who should be in power, political power.
Yeah, and especially when thinking about Brazil, today Professor Roth spoke at the AF, and you can check it out on YouTube to see her full talk if you wish, but you spoke about the racial history of Brazil and its interaction. And could you speak a little bit more about that, and if there was a difference in finding abortions about white women versus African women, like black women, if there was an, like, even I know there's a big native population in Brazil too.
Yeah, that is a great question. So the racial politics of Brazil are different than the United States, but they've often been constructed in contrast to the United States. So Brazil was the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery in 1888. And it was the largest slave society in the Atlantic world. So it imported, forcibly imported nearly 5 million enslaved Africans. If you want to compare that to the United States, which was less than 500,000. The enslaved population in the United States did reproduce itself biologically, and that did not happen in Brazil for the most part. So at one point, the slave population was larger in the United States than Brazil, even though they imported fewer African captives. So that being said, in the post-abolition period in Brazil, you didn't have strict segregation policies like Jim Crow, right? And Brazilian leaders said, well, that's because there's harmonious racial relations, and thus we don't have racism because racism is only what happens in the United States. And, you know, to some extent, they didn't have segregation, but it was an incredibly racist society based on the idea that white people were superior biologically, intellectually, politically, right? And they had the power. And that doesn't go away just because you don't have segregation. But in the realm of reproduction, what I found was, one, I can't definitively say, you know, if white women or black women or indigenous women had abortions at different rates, because we just don't have that information. When abortion is criminalized, we don't have accurate data. I didn't see that specific women were criminalized at higher rates in the documents, but it just happens that most poor women were of African descent or indigenous descent. And so if most poor people are people of color and they have the least access to safe medical care, they're going to sort of be criminalized. You're going to see them in the criminal documents at higher rates. I think, though, that the one thing I found different in Brazil than what we've read in the U.S. is the U.S. had a eugenics movement that actively sterilized, in the early 20th century, sterilized black women, poor white women, women, other minority women, Mexican-American women. And you don't see that in Brazil. So there was this belief that because of this harmonious racial relations, that by allowing everyone to reproduce and just educating them to be better citizens, eventually you would have a wider, better nation, because interracial sexuality or the would lead to a wider population. So this changes to some extent in the late 20th century in Brazil. There were accusations of racially based sterilization programs in the 70s and 80s, and although investigations into that didn't find differentials in the race of women who were sterilized, it did find that many physicians had racist ideas about who should be reproducing. And that there was the fear that if Black people were reproducing at higher rates than white people would lose political power. So that was a real thing in the late 20th century in Brazil, even if the state never had specific sterilization policies.
You mentioned that Brazil is sometimes compared to the States. Why do you think that is, and how do you fit that into like the discussion of reproductive health?
So I think one of the main reasons that Brazil is compared to the United States is because of the history and legacy of slavery in both countries. Brazil and the United States were the largest slave-owning and most powerful slave-owning societies until the abolition of slavery. And so in that sense, the post-abolition histories of the countries have been compared, both by intellectuals in the United States and in Brazil. So, you know, Brazil is also the largest nation in Latin America and the second largest nation in the Americas behind the United States. And it's a rising power on the global stage. So in that sense, it makes sense to have these two powerful nations be compared. You know, it's interesting because I think sometimes, especially in the United States, feminists, more liberal feminists, middle class feminists, white feminists have sort of have differentiated between the United States and Latin America, where Latin America is backwards and more conservative in relation to reproductive rights, whereas the United States is not. And we've seen that recently that's just not the case, that the United States, the Supreme Court overturned Roe in last year. And on the other hand, countries in Latin America, not Brazil, but Colombia, Argentina, Mexico, Uruguay, they have all decriminalized abortion. And they've done so through strong feminist movements that are interclass and that are based on notions of human rights. So actually, feminists and organizers in the United States really do need to be looking towards countries in Latin America as a path forward. So in that sense, we could compare ourselves to Latin American nations in a sort of in a negative sense.
And thinking about more about this comparison of countries, I think United States, as you said, we had the right to an abortion that got overturned. Historically, Brazil has never had the right to abortion. It's always been illegal. Is there any hope for countries to implement, to codify the right for abortion that historically there's been a lot of backlash, either culturally or legal-wise?
Yeah. So I was just at a conference about sort of Roe v. Wade at 50, and the conference was planned before Roe v. Wade was overturned. And so the organizer called it Roe v. Wade past and prologue, because it's the past, but it's the prologue to a different future. So one thing the people at the conference were talking about was that it's bad right now in the United States. It's bad, and we can't deny that. And women and people who can be pregnant will die, and they will suffer because abortion has been criminalized. But it won't always be like this. And the past does show us that with organized fights and movements, we can have more expansive bodily autonomy. It's happened before. And the history of reproductive health and abortion in particular is one of waves of criminalization and decriminalization. And so it doesn't mean we can sit back and just wait for that to happen. It takes organizing, but it won't always be like this. So I think that looking at places that have successfully decriminalized abortion in Latin America, that's the way forward. So in many countries, for example, Argentina, which had a very violent military dictatorship in the late 20th century, and after the military dictatorship had sort of constitutions with human rights based or included in them, feminists they successfully reframed abortion as violence against women, and violence against women is an attack on women's human rights, right? And so that's how they've looked at abortion. They haven't even taken it. It's not about reducing the numbers of abortions. It's about a woman's bodily autonomy is a human right. And if we are going to have human rights after these military dictatorships, then bodily autonomy has to be part of that. And that has been successful. So I think we have to think about expanding rights in general, the rights of all people, all people's bodily autonomy. And abortion rights is included in that, but it's not the only thing, right? So when we expand bodily rights for everyone, then everyone wins. We don't have to exclude people who don't identify as women who can get pregnant. We can include them in this fight for bodily autonomy. And that's why, you know, I view reproductive justice, it's about the right to have an abortion, to not have an abortion if you don't want to, and to raise your children with dignity and economic opportunity, right? And so this also can include reproductive justice, can include rights for trans people, healthcare rights. And I think that we have to be expansive and have allies. The only thing I'll say is that I think in the United States, we really just have to abolish the Electoral College and probably the Senate. It's a little bit, you know, instigation, but I always tell my students, you know, the Supreme Court would look very different today if the popular vote was what decided the presidents of the last 20 years.
How does teaching and researching about abortion differ from domestically in America versus other countries? Did you notice a difference in how the subject is studied in America versus Latin America from your experiences like teaching in college and being a researcher yourself?
Yeah, I think my experience in Brazil, again, I'm sort of moving within an echo chamber, as I would say in Brazil. It's an academic echo chamber where everyone believes that women should have the right to have an abortion, but to some different extent. But it's really the way I've seen it framed in Brazil is a public health issue, which it absolutely is. When abortion is criminalized, it does not reduce. It's been shown over and over again, it doesn't reduce the number of abortions. It just makes them more dangerous. And the people who most suffer are poor women, right? And in Brazil, with the legacy of slavery, most poor women are women of color. So it is an issue of public health, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But it's also an issue of bodily autonomy. And so I think the way I've seen it from the public health standpoint, it's an important point to make, but there's larger fights to be had here. In the right in Brazil is increasingly becoming more and more like the right in the United States, which is talking about fetal rights since the moment of conception and sort of placing the fetus and the mother in an antagonistic opposition to each other rather than the pregnant person or the woman being able to make the best decision for her and her family and her future. In the United States, I think teaching about abortion is really important. And I do want to respect, I mean, it's pretty clear from how I teach and what I write about that I think abortion should be legal. And I don't hide that because there's no point in pretending I'm not being political because we don't have the luxury of not being political. But I do want to respect people's different personal approaches toward abortion and including religious understandings of life. And so I just try to historicize what we know today. So I'll just briefly, when I talk about this idea that life begins at the moment of conception as a Catholic tenet, that the Catholic Church for centuries vacillated back and forth about when life began. And for a long time, they did not believe in immediate animation, which is when the egg is fertilized. But it wasn't until 1869 when that became a definitive sort of doctrine from the Catholic Church. So I just try to show students that, you know, what we believe about life is also historically and socially contingent, right? It matters on when we live and who and where we live.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But before we go, as you just released your book and we've been reading it, we've been enjoying it, we had a question for you. Is there a new release or piece of media that's been on your mind that you could recommend to our listeners?
Oh, that is a great
aside from your book, which yeah. I really...
So there is a documentary on HBO called The Jane Collective. So it seems like maybe you've seen it. I think that's what it's called, or Jane's. And it's based on a book about this collective of women who provided abortions before Roe v. Wade in Chicago. And I just think the documentary does a really great job. But also, I just reread the book, and it's a really it's a good read, and I think it does a good job of talking about race and class politics before Roe v. Wade, and it can provide some inspiration to people who felt really lost after Roe was overturned.
Well, Professor Roth, thank you so much for coming today.
That's unfortunately all the time we have, but again, to our listeners, remember to stay hungry. Thank you.